Post-Harlan Monologics. Number 00010. Recorded on January 16, 2023. Production location, Post. Harlan. Texas. The Enterprise. Chapter 10.
The opinions of Maverick 88 are not necessarily the opinions of Maverick 88. Sensitive content warning. Viewer discretion is advised.
Now, buckle up. You are on the runaway train of thought. Ladies and gentlemen, without any further ado, the one, the only, Maverick 88.
Yes, of course, you are on the runaway train of thought, right? And it's no mistake that I have chosen that descriptor of this monologue program, right? This monologue show, which I call Monologics. It's a train of thought, on the one hand, which is linking topic to topic, subject to subject, in a pretty fluid, linear manner that ends up starting from one point and ending up in some crazy, unimaginable end. This is what I intend to do, right? This is what I intend to do, and that's my runaway train of thought. It's a train of thought, but then the runaway aspect of it is the idea that you really don't know where this thing is going to go, right? But it's still a train, and it's still on tracks. It ain't derailed, right? I'm kind of keeping it contiguous as best as I can do. But at the same time, you end up in a very unexpected place, right? So that may be the distinction that you get, like the obvious distinction that you would get with me, with Post-Harlan Monologics, is the idea of Texas, about DFW, North Texas, right, as my geographical home base, my current experience and recent experience going back 15 years, all takes place around here. But of course, as you listen to me, you understand that I come originally from New Jersey, and I've gotten to Texas by way of Georgia, Tennessee, and there was other less significant stops on the way, actually, in my life besides that. But, my stories are going to incorporate all these places I've been through my time. So, of course, there's a lot of Maverick 88 injected into this monologue. Whether you like it or not, I guess it's just that way. Hopefully I'm a likable enough person that you can tolerate it, right? And hear where this is going and get what it's worth. But because of this, the varied locations in my life, I've gained a lot of experience on the way, right? There's a lot of things I chose not to do that freed me up to do other things. I've gotten to try a lot more things in this world, in this lifetime, than an ordinary person gets to do, right? So there's a little value added to that. Of course, for me now, it takes a lot of the color and flavor out of my existence. I don't have, for example, children and grandchildren to come along the way. I passed on that, right? I didn't build up like a solid career end to end. I didn't work for some company for 30, 40, 50 years and have a nice retirement set up, all that. You know, I've given some things up. So there's a lot of loss, and that's my problem. And what I've gained is to your benefit. I have stories to tell, right? So it's a train of thought that we go through, starting one from one topic and trying to deliver you somewhere you would not expect to end up, right? It's runaway in that regard, but still, it is a train on tracks, contiguous. And, you know, the idea of runaway train comes to me, you know, in my experiences, I'm talking about them. You know, one experience I runaway train is actually a roller coaster, right? A roller coaster. Now, here's where some New Jersey comes into play. We're going to go back to my junior high years, right? I'm guessing when I was probably about the age of 12 is my best guess, possibly 13. I was probably in the seventh or eighth grade, and we were on an outing with a bunch of family friends. It was like five boys and two mothers, and we took a trip down into the southern part of New Jersey to an amusement park, right? It's a Six Flags theme park. Six Flags is a large chain of amusement parks around the United States. I don't know how many of them there are, but I know they're in a lot of places. We have one here in Dallas, right? Not in Dallas, but actually DFW, Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex, our general area, what I refer to as post-Arlen, Texas. And in post-Arlen, Texas, our Six Flags is called Six Flags. It's in Arlington, and that's what everybody calls it. Six Flags theme park or amusement park. In New Jersey, it is a Six Flags, but everybody up there, including myself down here, refers to that park as Great Adventure. It's always been that way. It's Six Flags Great Adventure, but we've always called it Great Adventure. So I'm going to refer to it in that regional regard. And in that theme park, they had a roller coaster that was called the Runaway Train. And I'm pretty sure it's gone by now. So many rides in that park over all these years have been decommissioned, right? That park goes all the way back to the 70s, I think, when it originated. And, you know, so when I start talking about the rides in that park, most of them are probably gone by now. I'm sure at least some of them are completely gone. But the Runaway Train, my story with that, Runaway Train was this real metal, like rusty, rickety metal piece of shit, right? Like the whole thing vibrated, you know? It was built up like at least partially, if not fully, over some kind of swamp water, right? For ambiance, for the effect. It was like, I think in the frontier part of the park or something like that, but it was like on water somehow. There's some kind of lake that was really swampy and looking, I don't know, but it's built right into it, and it was just rusty. It was just all this rusty steel and really rickety, you know. As you go around turns, the whole fucking thing wobbles, and you were like in fear that you just wouldn't make it to the end of the ride, right? It wasn't a harrowing like G-force kind of ride where you're like doing loop the loops. No, it was really kind of plain Jane, you know, really kind of, but it was just so clunky and unstable. You were just afraid that you were going to derail or rivets were going to pop out and the fucking thing was going to collapse. It was just that. It was just this rickety thing, you know, and it really did give you the sense of like, and I think what it was trying to achieve is the idea of something of like a tracks through like a silver mine, you know, and you're on a cart, something like that, you know. It just had that real old feel to it, and the uncertainty that goes along with it. A part of the thing, and here's like the story of it that, you know, in my recollection, part of the ride, like it got you up to a high level, and then it kind of descended slowly through this spiral downward, right? It just made this big spiral that it was like a cylinder, basically, from the sky down to that swamp water. And as we were spinning around it, there was just like this offshoot of lightning. Like we had on and off thunderstorms going through that day. And just some cloud just like spit out this little flash of lightning. And it was not a big thing. It was not explosive or anything, but it was just this flat, and it zipped. And you could see the streak just go right through this spiral that we were spiraling down, right? Right in the middle of the cylinder, down into the water. It was like, whoa. And you could feel it, too. You could feel, like, you know, the static, like, pull up the hair on your body and shit. A fucked up thing. But, yeah, it was the Runaway Train roller coaster at Six Flags Great Adventure in Jackson, New Jersey, going back to probably the year, like, shit, 1980? I'm guessing 80, 81, somewhere around then. Right? So way back in the way back. And another runaway train that's a part of my existence. And this is actually more contemporary and basically like a daily part of my life almost. You know, it's music, right? It's a song. It's a song called Runaway Train. See, I've downloaded, I don't know, a couple hundred, few hundred songs on my iPhone, you know, my Apple smartphone. I think I'm on our version 11. I'm not big into it. I just, you know, I end up with a phone and that's it. I pay for it and I use it. It's a mini computer. We call them smartphones in this day and age. It's a handheld computer device. It's small, has telephone service built into it. And there's all kinds of groovy things you can do, you know. And with this device, the generation is defined. We've got a lot of young zombie type of kids in Generation Z is what we're calling it. And before that, the generation of millennials, which, you know, in alphabetical order would be Y. And I'm from Generation X, right? So the two generations following the generation I'm part of. And this is a cultural distinction, right? Generation X goes from, like, it's debated, you know, it's just sociology shit, you know, but it kind of encapsulates like certain elements of culture through time, and the people who live at a certain age through that period of time are referred to in a sociological descriptor. Mine is Generation X, which loosely is people who were born from the years of 65 through 80. And then you have a Generation Y, which is called the Millennials, which goes from, you know, people born from like 1980 on to, I guess, the millennium, 2000. It's like a 20. I'm not positive about that. And then the people who are born from 2000 forward to the current time, which is 2023, are regarded as Generation Z. Like, I'm Generation X, they're Generation Z. And the Generation Y in the middle of it actually became known as millennials. And I don't know how that is. That's not my thing. It's a thing, but not my thing. But the millennials and the Generation Z people alike grew up in a world where there was always mobile phones, always computers, and especially for this Generation Z, there was always smartphones. It's just always a part of their life. And they get their hands on their own, you know, their own phones, their own little handheld computers at young ages, you know. Some of them 5, 6 years old. Others have to wait till they're teenagers. It depends on the family. But all these young people now, they walk around and they're always like, you know, they got their phone held out in front of them. The phone is typically, you know, rectangular in shape, you know, it's flat rectangle. And it has a screen, which is a touch screen. You can touch elements on the screen to make the computer do things, right? So it's just about a continual passage of information, right? And it's really cool. You know, it's really space-age stuff. And we'll get into some space-age stuff. You know, ingenuity and science. And there's a lot of plus to it. And then there's some minus to it. But what we end up having is a lot of young people who are walking around. And they're holding this device out in front of them constantly. Whatever they're doing it in reference to their smartphone, right? Those of us like Generation X, yeah, we all got them and we all use them very frequently, but we could, like, you know, shut them off and put them in our pocket and do other things because we grew up in an era where there was no smartphone, there was no personal computers, you know? There was none of this, no internet, No instant communications of any kind except for a telephone, but your telephone was mounted in your house on a wall and it was attached to a cable, right? The actual physical analog cable system that ran on telephone poles, which we still have. It all this shit still exists. But once upon a time, that's all we had. And, you know, if you weren't sitting next to your phone, you didn't hear it ring. If you were out and about doing other things, you were incommunicado. There was no way to get hold of you, right? So we come from that kind of world, and this world as it is kind of grew up around us, and we kind of fit ourselves into it. We take, you know, what we need of it, what's practical. Whereas young people, kids, this is what they grew up with, and it's like an appendage to them. And they walk around, you know, they'll cross a busy city street looking down at their phone without no mind left or right, up or down, just whatever's in the phone. And they think that the world ought to stop around them, right? It's their culture. It's the way they roll, you know? And that's the modern age. But I got this phone and I use it the way I use it. And part of my usage of the phone is for music, right? I love music. I play guitar. I write songs. I've just started doing that again, starting to record into the computer. It's been like 5 years since I just started back into that, and I'm happy about that in general. But I love music, so I download, right, on this phone all kinds of music. You know, I got to pay for it and shit, but I do. Little here, little there. I'll take like two or three songs, and there it goes, $5 or $6. And I just do that every couple of weeks or so. Now I got like 300 songs or something like that. And one of these songs, right now, like I said, one of the songs is called Runaway Train, and it fits in my, we could categorize the songs we have into certain groups for a playlist, right? In these playlists, you're like, whatever, you like country music and you like rock, you make one that's country music, and then you put all your country songs in this playlist. You have rock and roll from like the 50s. You say 50s rock and roll, and you put all your 50s rock and roll songs on that playlist. So whatever mood you're in the mood for 50s rock and roll, or you're in the mood for country, or you're in the mood for hip hop, or whatever, you know, whatever musical genre, or however you want to categorize your songs, you'd make create playlists, right? Now I got this song, Runaway Train, that in my playlist, and it's not relegated to genre. That's an example I use. I have one playlist, for example, that is like trucking songs, right? Just songs that involve truck driving. Because I get in a mood for that sort of thing. I used to drive a truck, and there's a feeling it gives me about just being on the open road, right? I listen to those kind of songs, and it's a mood. But it might be rock. It could be folk. It could be whatever. Obviously, it's going to be country, as long as they're talking about trucking, right? So that's like one playlist that I make, one way I categorize music. And Runaway Train is a trucking song, right? As far as I'm concerned. I have songs that are just like strictly Texas artists, you know, a playlist for that. Country music, old country music, I got all these different genres that, or all these different playlist categories that I make, and this one fucking song, it's one of those songs I got that kind of like jumps to so many of my playlists. It's not on every, but it's on most. So whatever playlist I want to put on, here's my point. Runaway Train is a song I'm hearing. maybe at like somewhere near the core of my musical tastes as they are currently, right? Runaway Train is a song made by a musician, a singer, and a guitar player, songwriter, Dale Watson, right? And I've spoken about him before. If you've listened before, if you go back to, I think, the very first episode I've done here where I'm really describing post-Arlen, Texas, you know, he's a figure in that. He's one of what I call my accessible musicians. There's a circuit of musicians that go around that play old country, rockabilly, surf rock, psychobilly, and just all kinds of mixtures therein. And they play these smaller places around here, like honky tonk type of places. Not real small, but not big. And they'll play like, you know, maybe festivals that are around whenever they're around. There used to be a festival over in Richardson. I don't know if they're still doing it or not, called the Wildflower Festival. But these are guys that they're really, really, really good, right? Very talented people. You could see them for anywhere between free and like $20. And then when the show's over, they'll come and hang out with you, you know? They try to do that with Led Zeppelin or one of those arena bands. You don't get anywhere near those kind of people, right? They're ultra famous. But so I got this kind of grouping of what I call accessible musicians and genres of music that I really like. And these guys are just spectacular. And Dale Watson's one of them. Now, Dale Watson, yeah, he's basically a Texas guy. Not necessarily born here, but raised here. He does a lot of his stuff centered out of Austin. He lives over by Shreveport, Louisiana now. So people will call that his home base, perhaps. But really, the heart of his following is Austin, Texas, which is capital Texas. And he's got a catalog that goes back to like 1990, 1989. A lot of good stuff. He plays a Telecaster. Plays the hell out of it. I mean, I got a Telecaster. I got a nice American Telecaster that I play. I can't play it like this guy plays it. Not even close. He's, as a guitarist alone, he's exceptional talent. He's got a great singing voice, right? Just kind of like on the low side, very masculine singing voice. And then he's a songwriter. He writes all these songs too, and they're great songs. And they're more or less, mostly a lot of fun, right? When you see him, when you see a show of his in a honky tonk, it's a lot of beer drinking songs, you know, and a lot of good times. He interacts with the crowd, and the crowd fucks with him, and everybody's like brings him a beer, and he's got to drink it. And it's about that, you know. This is kind of back and forth, but he's really a down to earth dude, real independent streak. Kind of guy. He's an independent artist, you know, and he's on his tour bus and he does his thing and he does his thing his way, and it's really great, you know. His big thing, he's a country guy, a honky tonk, a Texas honky tonk kind of country player with a little bit of rock, you know, like old, like a rockabilly feel to him. But his thing is like authenticity of country music. So he's like really, in his mind, all about old country. Like that's the only country I listen to is old country that goes back, you know, previous to the 80s, right? The analog era of country music. That's what I like, and that's what he's all about. So when he makes his songs that are, and most of them are country oriented, it's going to be within the... I guess the established strictures of what defines actual country. You know, he's got a song that speaks to this whole idea. Country my ass. That's country my ass, right? And he's making fun of all the modern stuff. The song lyrics, as you go through, tells a story about like, you know, young country people in the modern day and age. Complaining they've been on the road for 5 days and you know they're trying to express themselves as battle worn. They are only like, you know, 10 miles from home and they're already like all tired from the road wear, you know, just shit like that. Everything is like this artificial version of country, this plastic version of country. You know, here's a guy who lived a life and did it the hard way, did it his way, so it was double hard. And yeah, that's country my ass. Love it. It's great stuff. Another thing, and this is not necessarily his thing, but it's a thing down in Austin that I never heard about until I see him posting it. See, he spends a lot of his time in Austin, and he plays a couple of places down there, Continental Club and whatever. There's one of them, and the name escapes me. I don't go to Austin. I don't know Austin. Austin's like, you know, San Francisco of Texas. It's not a place for me in general. If I happen to be there when he's there, I'll go see him, you know, but that's not my place. They do a thing. It's a cultural thing in Austin, which I think is really cool. You'll probably think it's disgusting and stupid and hokey and weird and shit, but it's a game. It's a bar game called And I'm not kidding you. Chicken shit bingo, right? Chicken shit bingo. What the hell is chicken shit bingo? I ask myself the same question, you know, because I just see, I go through my social media, there's Dale Watson, he's like, oh, I'll be in Austin at this place, Sunday afternoon, because it's apparently it's a Sunday afternoon thing that they do in Austin, for chicken shit bingo. So he plays music while they're playing chicken shit bingo, he takes part in it. What's chicken shit bingo? They make a cage around a board, right? So a big board, maybe the size like, oh, I don't know, 8 foot by 8 foot, 6 foot by 6 foot, square. They put up chicken wire walls around the outside of it. So it's a chicken cage. And on the board, on the floor of it, they script in some squares and make a bingo board out of it, right? And then they throw down some kind of like seeds and corn, and they'll put a chicken in the middle of it, and the chicken will go around pecking at the corn and everything. And if you know anything about chickens, I used to raise chickens in Tennessee, which is a really cool thing and a fun thing. If you ain't done it and you can do it and you're thinking about it, take that step. You'll thank me for it. It helps you in life in a lot of ways. But anyway, you know anything about chickens, they just kind of wander around, they eat off the ground, and then they just drop shit wherever, right? They literally just shit. And this is what we're doing here. When you play the game of bingo, normally you're pulling like ping pong balls with numbers that represent different squares on the board, right? And you just kind of pull out of a hat or a feeder of some sort. It can be fancy or it could not be so fancy. You pull out the number, it's like a number letter call relation, you know, letters down the side, like B-I-N-G-O for bingo, and then they'll have numbers across the top or however it goes. So you get like, you know, B-3, and then everybody's got their little score pads, and which have like just random placement of numbers, and if you got those particular numbers on it, you mark it off. And if you get like 5 in a row, you got bingo, right? And you say, oh, bingo, and then you win the prize, whatever it is. So rather than pulling ping pong balls out of some kind of hat or feeder, the letters and numbers called for the squares are determined where the chicken shits. That's why it's chicken shit bingo, and I think that's just great. You know, it has to be a Texas thing, right? It has to be a Texas thing. I don't know the entire history of the game, but from what I gather so far, it's just something that spawned out of Austin area of Texas, right? Deep in the heart of Texas. And it's funny as shit. And, Dale Watson does shows around the premise of chicken shit bingo. And I would like to see one of those. I think that would be fun, you know? Going back to like the whole great adventure thing, though, the rides, right? You had the runaway train. There's other ones that I can recall. There's probably a lot of other ones I can recall if I really think about it. But just to give you an idea, like these theme parks, you know, some of the variety, you know, like most of the shit is roller coasters, right? Or some variety of roller coaster. A big attraction in the beginning with the when Great Adventure opened up was their log flume. Now, I think they had a small one and a bigger one. And when they were doing the marketing on the television back then, you know, that's what they would always show. The log flume was kind of like a roller coaster, but it was more like this half tunnel with water rolling on it. And then it had like a cart that floated, like a boat. But it was like made out of some kind of material that looked like, you know, wood. It was some kind of faux wood stuff, maybe plastic, fiberglass. And it would kind of float through this tunnel system. It would start high and just, you know, gravity would take it around turns and everything. And at the end of it, you would have like this big drop off, right? Steep thing. And at the bottom of the drop off would be this big pool of water. So your boat cart thing would go down that drop and you'd hit that water and make this humongous splash, right? And then there'd be people like walking across a footbridge in front of it. If it's a hot summer day, they stand there and just get splashed to cool off. But that was the log flume, right? And that was kind of a big deal. It wasn't a hair-raising ride or anything like that, but, you know, that was like the initial attraction, you know? And then they had the big Rolling Thunder. It was an old wooden, you know, big white wooden roller coaster ride, kind of long, you know, big uphill, you know, riding up a like a chain pulling you up this hill. You know, you just way high up in the sky, right? You get to the top, you're looking left, you're looking right. You could see far, far away. You know, you could see like Pennsylvania from there and shit, right? And you come over the top and it would just be this steep, almost free fall downhill to give you the momentum for the entire ride through, right? Nothing mechanical about it at that point. You were just in a cart that was on a rail, going down these tracks that were on this whole wooden structure, right? So it's a very antiquated looking type of thing. And you went really fast because it was, you know, almost a free fall drop at the beginning. And it was pretty lengthy. And you whipped around turns, you know. If you weren't paying attention, you can get yourself hurt. You know? You'd throw your neck out one way or something like that. So yeah, they'd be a little bit mindful of it. You know, those old style roller coasters were a little bit rugged. They weren't really smooth. So you had to be a little bit mindful of it. But that was a ride there. And then they upgraded it. I remember it was a huge deal. You know, later on in the 70s, they came up with this roller coaster called Lightning Loops, right? Lightning Loops. And all it really was a loop-de-loop, right? You started on one side, flat. You had that kind of near free-fall drop. And it would send you into a loop-de-loop. A loop-de-loop is basically you go upside down, right? You go into a loop, go upside down at the top of the loop, and then come back down to the bottom. Then you'd shoot up another uphill, you know, equal to the one that you drop down at free fall, and you get to the top and come out to another flat part, right? Or nearly flat part. You'd stop, all momentum would cease, and then you'd get thrown backwards and do the same thing in reverse. And that was the ride. Just forward, one big loop, and then backward through that same loop. But at that time, because every ride now does loop-de-loops like crazy in all kinds of manners. But back then, that was a big deal. That was innovative, you know, to actually be upside down in a ride without falling out. They built these special like shoulder harnesses and everything like that, which became standard, right? So that was Lightning Loops. And man, that was a 76, 77. That was just a huge deal. Every kid is like, did you get to go on Lightning Loops yet? And like, no, not yet, man, but I got to go. You know, you had to do it. You had to go on Lightning Loops. And I remember one time there, a couple years later, as a teenager, a bunch of my friends. This is just a little ride. I'm going to tell you about this. It's the rotor story, okay? The rotor story. My infamous rotor story. I've told it many times to all kinds of people, and everybody gets a kick out of it. But, you know, I was a teenager, and I was on drugs and shit, you know. I mean, a bunch of my friends hopped in a car, some old, you know, pseudo fucking muscle car from, like, the early 70s, you know. I don't remember what it was, either like a Pontiac or a Oldsmobile, some kind of GM, but it was like a Chevy Nova wannabe, but it wasn't a Chevy Nova. It was something very similar, built by General Motors, who, you know, was like the corporate company of all these different with these different divisions, like Pontiac, like Oldsmobile, both of which are defunct now. Also Buick, also Chevrolet, right? And you know, each division would make their version of the same car. Chevy Nova was the big one out of GM of its kind. It was like a mid-sized muscle car. I had one, you know, with a 350 in it, and that fucking thing hauled ass, right? That was a big motor for the size of that thing. But then there was like iterations of it that weren't Chevys. They were Pontiacs and Oldsmobiles. So we're in this car. It's like this faded, pale, fucking green, ugly thing. Six cylinder. You know, that's why I call it pseudo. It was a body design of a muscle car, but it had the engine of like, I was going to say something really derogatory. This is what you call a small engine, right? Weak, wimpy, wussy. And we all hop in it. I had five, maybe six of us. Just a bunch of dudes, no girls. We drive down. It's a really long story. I mean, we went down the shore first, and we went over to Jackson, New Jersey, where Great Adventure is. We went to the theme park, the amusement park. We were all on all kinds of drugs, you know, including LSD. So we were psychedelic, tripping out, drunk, smoking pot in the place, you know. And just hitting all the rides. And once we first got there, we first got started, like one of the first rides we went on was just off, like, you know, the central part of, like, the main gate. It had a little wing of, like, these old-style kind of ground rides. They weren't roller coasters, per se, loop-de-loops and all, well, sort of, kind of. Almost like kiddie rides, but a little bit more daring. You wouldn't throw, you know, a five-year-old on a ride like this, you know. But they were more old-style, more like, I guess you would call them... like traveling carnivals, when they have their rides at traveling carnivals, those type, you know, probably a better grade, better quality, but those type of rides. And I'll talk about two of them here. One of them here, this is the rotor story. The rotor is a ride that was a cylinder. That's all. It was a cylinder, maybe, 20 feet across, and all that big. But it was a cylinder that had like rubber walls, and all it did was spin, right? All it did was spin around and around and around and around, and it would spin so fast it established G-force, and the G-force would pin you up to the rubber walls. So that was a ride. You'd get like stuck on the wall, and then somewhere in the middle of it, the floor would actually drop out the bottom. All right, you walk in, you're standing on a floor, now you're pinned to a wall, and then the floor drops out and you don't fall. You're stuck to the wall, right? Like spaghetti. So you throw spaghetti at the wall, see if it sticks. Or you could throw human beings at this wall, see if it sticks, right? Or they stick. So that was the ride. So you're just whipping around like counter or clockwise, as it was, if I recall right. You're going around clockwise, real fast, real fast, real fast, real fast. The floor drops out. You're stuck to the wall. And then the trick is like to try to like turn yourself upside down, or try to reach out into the center, try to peel yourself off the wall somehow. And that's really like all the teenagers are doing. They're like trying to show their physical prowess by doing all this zany, crazy stuff in the midst of G-force, right? And the way it's set up is you have a stairway that kind of goes up, right? You have lines out on the ground. And then as you're getting closer to the front of line, you get to go up this little stairway. When you get to the top of the stairway, there's a wraparound platform. Right, it goes around in a circle, and you gain your entry off of that platform. Right, you know, part of the interior wall of the spinning cylinder opens up as a door. There's a little step down into there, if I remember it right. But you get to, before your turn to go on this ride, you get to see everybody else on the ride. So you're looking on this platform, looking over this railing at what's going on inside of there. So we're up there, we're all tripping and drunk and stoned and whatever we were on, and just having a good time. And we're watching the set of people, the group of people who were on the rotor ride before we were. And just like I described to you, you know, it spins round and round and round, and everybody gets stuck to the wall, and the floor drops out. And somewhere in the middle of all this ruckus, some teenage girl throws the fuck up, right? She got some kind of bad hamburger and fries or whatever, the cotton candy. It all just ended up out in the middle, right? She puked out her mouth, and instead of it just dropping to the floor like it normally would, it just slowly just drifted like a cloud out into the very center of this spinning circle. And with the G-force and everything happening around, it just hovered there like a cloud. It was the most fucked up thing, you know? I know I was tripping, but this is true. This really happened because everybody else will corroborate the story, right? They seen it too, right? This puke, you had this like cloud of puke just floating in the middle, and everybody stuck to the wall is now not concerned about going upside down, not concerned about trying to peel themselves off the wall and showing off for their girlfriend or whatever. Now they're concerned with that fucking puke that's floating out in the middle. Because don't you know, the ride will eventually slow down. And it did. It starts slowing down, the G-force starts to lay off, and like for every 5 miles an hour slower this ride spins, a chunk of that puke just shoots out. And then another chunk shoots out. And it just started breaking down piece by piece. And it was just shooting out all over. Everybody got hit with it, right? Just puking. And we're up top over the railing looking down, seeing the whole thing. What a great view of this event, right? It was the funniest fucking thing. And everybody's just grossed out. They're pissed off. They're cussing this girl out. She's like green and purple because she got sick in the middle of this ride. And that ride just kept on going. There was nowhere for her to go. No way to get there. That's funny. What sucked is now we had to wait like 15 minutes. They got a cleaning crew in there and mop buckets and mops and rags and hoses and shit, clean all the puke out. It was a measurable quantity, if you want to get scientific about it. There was quantifiable vomit flying around in that fucking place. And everybody's coming off, like wiping it off their face and out of their eyes and their hair. Girls got chunks in their hair and disgusting. And it smelled bad too. It was summertime. It was humid in New Jersey and you were in a swampy part. Temperature, the sun and everything. It smelled all over the place. They bleached the fuck out of it. So it smelled like bleach when we got on there. But now just down the way a little bit from the rotor was another ride. It was called the Enterprise, right? The Enterprise. Actually, technically, it was the Enterprise 2. There was a replacement for it, which is really, really encouraging, right? You get on a ride that a previous rendition of it needed to be replaced for some reason. And what this ride was, a little different. It's like, if you know what a Ferris wheel is, or if you don't, whatever. Ferris wheel is like this big wheel, right? A big wheel. It's got a central point to it. Spokes that run out of it. At the end of the spokes, you got carts that hang down. And, it's a vertical standing wheel. And it just kind of slowly spins around and around. And like the big thrill of it is you get set at a variety of altitudes. And, you get a perspective of your surroundings that it's cool. You're way up high and you get to see some shit, right? It's docile and you could sit there and have a conversation. We as kids back then, you could sit there and smoke weed, more of a social gathering place than a ride or an amusement, but it's an old style one, right? So it goes way back to prior centuries and shit. The idea, the concept of it, I think there's some dispute about the actual origins of it, and the Ferris guy might have stole it from somebody else. I don't know. I don't know all that. That's not my concern right here, right now. But the Enterprise is like a Ferris wheel, except it lays horizontally instead of standing vertically, right? So what you have is like an aperture arm that has a center at the end of it. And from that center, spokes shooting out. And at the end of the spokes, just like the Ferris wheel, carts hanging down, right? The difference is this thing spins very quickly, right? You get in there, maybe two people in a car. It spins around and around and around, like 85 miles an hour or more. You get like a whole G-force effect and everything. In fact, you start out, your cart is just dangling vertically, just hanging there like on chains or whatever. And then as you start picking up speed, you become horizontal. The bottom of your cart just shoots way out to the left. And, you're sideways, perpendicular or parallel, I should say, to the ground. And, you're spinning around, spinning around, spinning around. Then the crazy part of it is the arm, the aperture just starts raising up. And now your horizontal fast speeding Ferris wheel is upright, vertical, fast-speeding Ferris wheel, right? You're just up and down, whipping around, loop the loop, the loop, the loop, the loop. It's crazy, right? And then it comes back down slowly, levels out flat with the ground, slows down, stops, you get off, next people get on. Well, there was no next people, and we just kept on getting on and on and on and on. We did it three, four, five times in a row. You get off the thing, it's like your orientation now, you're like reverse NASCAR. Instead of everything just being left, 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 it's all right, right, right. You're like walking around right ways in a circle and shit. It's fucked up. We were on drugs and everything, so that just enhanced that that impediment, right? But yeah, it was that Enterprise is what it was called. And it was named after a vehicle, a transport, a starship, a spaceship from a very iconic television series that came out in the 1960s called Star Trek. Star Trek. We refer to it now as the original series, but back then it was simply Star Trek. And their conveyance was the starship USS Enterprise, right? So this amusement ride was fashioned after the idea of this USS Enterprise. You know, they had designed it with certain aerodynamics and shapes, and maybe they had signs up around it that had depictions of the starship Enterprise. I forget exactly those kind of details, but that was the basic gist of it. That was the atmosphere they tried to set up around it, that you're on the starship Enterprise from Star Trek. Now, Star Trek, first of all, if you're a contemporary human being, especially in America, but even in Europe and other parts of the world too, you know Star Trek. I'm an old dude. I'm 55 at the time of this recording, and Star Trek actually predates my existence by a year. There's 56 years of Star Trek and counting, right? This is a cultural, pop cultural phenomenon, right? As far as television goes, and it was three seasons in the 60s, 1966, 1967, 1968. It ran for three seasons and then got cut to the disappointment of many, because it was really a great show. Very low production. You know, you watch it now, it's like comical to see like the backgrounds, the sets that they used for it. But that show was never about that. It was never about the bells and the whistles. It was about the content of the interaction with the actors, the characters. Really good. Excellent casting, excellent writing, and the story, the context of the stories. Very thought-provoking, you know. It challenged your mind and forced you to question the status quo. And a mind like mine, which is very exploratory, you know. I'm kind of an open-minded person, way more so than people would ever think, I think. But I don't know. Maybe people recognize that fact in me, you know. It really jived with me. But I was never really a big fan of it. You know, I was kind of indifferent. I watched the whole original series, as I call it now, that Star Trek from the 60s, in its syndications throughout my life. They're always on TV somewhere. It's just one of those shows, like I say, iconic. It's literally an iconic pop cultural phenomenon. So it was always on. So you just, you know, you're in proximity to it so frequently through so many years, you know what's going on with it. I've seen every episode, not realizing I've seen every episode. I know all the characters, and I definitely know the basic gist of it, and that's without being any level of fanatical about it at all. Just like I said, indifferent. Until recently, I just kind of picked it up and I started watching that original series again. Now, that original series spawned off into an entire entertainment empire, right? Movies and TV and cartoons. And to this day, you know, to this day, they're still generating more and more versions. You know, they're adding stories, they're making sequels, they're filling in all kinds of details between the lines. And all through it, the thread is this Starship Enterprise, right? Now, there's exceptions. There's certain what I regard as non-Enterprise television series based on Star Trek. And I don't even put them in the same light. If you ain't got the Starship Enterprise, you're kind of off the track, right? Because you could follow a linear pattern. And that's what I'm going to do here. There's a linear pattern of iterations of the Enterprise, right? There wasn't just one single USS Enterprise. There was one, then there was a better one. It got destroyed, and then there was a replacement for that, which got destroyed. Then there was a replacement with this that got retired, that kind of shit. And you end up getting, you know, quite the handful, quite the sequence of different USS Enterprise vehicles, spaceships, you know, going through time, through our culture. And like in the original series now, you have It's numbered. There's an actual numbering system that goes to it, right? So in the original series you're watching in the 60s, you had the NCC-1701 Star Trek, right? And not only was it in the original series, it got revitalized with some of these sequential versions of Star Trek that are produced through time, right? It existed in movies, right? Star Trek, after a certain amount of time, like 10 years later, after they canceled the show on TV, they started making movies, right? So there was a good bunch, like seven movies that were related to the original series, you know, following it in time as the characters aged and got older and went higher in rank and all that stuff. But through the first three movies in that sequence, you still had this Star Trek Enterprise NCC-1701. And then, you know, they were done with that by destruction, I think, if I remember right. And then they moved on to another iteration of the Enterprise from there in the following movies. But the first three movies had this same vehicle, the same transport. And then they had these, what's known as the reboot movies that came out between 09 and 16, right? 2009, 2016. And those three movies involved the same characters and the same Enterprise during that time. And now, right? Starting in 2022, you know, released last year, they have a new version of Star Trek called Strange New Worlds, which is actually an immediate prequel to the time of the original series in chronological terms, where you start out with the captain, right, the captain of the Starship Enterprise in the pilot episode of the original series in 1966 was Captain Pike, I think Christopher Pike. And he was brought back again in a two-part episode later on during the original series to finish out some story. But now they made a prequel to that, like the 5 years prior to the original series, sequentially in time, called Strange New Worlds. They've got one season of 10 episodes out now, and I've watched it. I've gone through it twice. I think it's great. You know, they recast those characters, and they did a pretty fucking good job of it. I recommend it, and, you know, they're going to have new seasons coming out in the next year or 2 years. Hopefully it goes on for a little while. But the time period that it's trapped within is 5 years, right? It's a five-year mission, so if they run a season a year at a time, you got 5 years worth of it. And honestly, I hope they manage to do that. I'd be content with that. It's really uncertain what the plans are and how those plans will be carried out. But it's very good, and I recommend it highly. Now, actually, the predecessor to that, that version of the USS Enterprise 1701, it was one called the NX-01. And that is viewable in a TV series called Star Trek Enterprise, right? Star Trek Enterprise, which ran from 2001 to 2005, right? So this is another prequel that kind of far predates not just the original series, not just Strange New Worlds, you know? It goes back even before then. In fact, before Strange New Worlds, chronologically in a story, there's another 5 or 10 year period of prequel that is not related to the Enterprise, but it's in the Star Trek universe. It's new. It's still running. I don't like it. It's called Star Trek Discovery, right? Discovery is a different conveyance, a different starship. But you know, chronologically speaking, there's several prequels, three that I am aware of, to the original series, right? So, but the one that goes furthest back at this time is flying around the Enterprise NX-01, right? Star Trek Enterprise, that was running from 01 to 05 with Captain Archer and a whole different crew. And it may be 100 years earlier. It's 50 or 100 years before all the original series and everything. So it goes back in time where things were like a lot more similar in this show and in their time frame to what they are actually now. It really wasn't much different, right? They started, like, they get the technology for warp drive engines, and they had this Enterprise, this version of Enterprise that only did warp 5, where in the original series they were doing warp 9. And I don't know what the mathematics is and the miles per hour between warp 5 and warp 6. It has something to do with the speed of light, but I don't really know. I don't know how that's described. You probably find that online somewhere. I'm not that deeply into it. That's all imagination shit anyway. As far as I know, I don't think that's any kind of like real science or math. But anyway, so you had that warp 5. It was like, you know, it was like the Volkswagen Beetle, the old Volkswagen Beetle of Star Trek Enterprises, right? It just didn't have the balls as any of the other ones to come did. And no pun intended there. I apologize. Keep your children away from me, please. There was, following the original series version of the Enterprise, the NCC-1701, you had the 1701-A. And that's the one that picked up in the fourth, fifth, and sixth movies, right? I mentioned about the first, second, and third movies before. After the Enterprise of the original series and the first three movies was defunct, the next three movies had this 1701A, right? And then also, there was a, following that, but coming significantly later, in our time, was a 1701B, right? Now, what I mean is, in 1994, there was a movie called Star Trek Generations made, which actually was a linkage between the original Star Trek cast and the new Star Trek The Next Generation cast. You had a relationship established between Captain Kirk and Captain Picard, even though they lived quite a few decades apart from one another. There was time travel, time warp type of stuff involved to make that happen. But that movie in 1994... was at the time with, if I understand it right, where Star Trek The Next Generation was actually wrapping up its production, right? It was at the end, but they made a movie that was hearkening back to the beginning of its historical timeline. You following me? I feel like I'm a little bit all over the place here. I'm trying to keep it rolling right along. So you had this moment where you had the 1701B that was used in that Star Trek Generations movie in 1994, but it predates the one that was actually used in the Star Trek The Next Generation, actually two of them that were used in Star Trek The Next Generation television series, right? Because the 1701C came out in a single episode. Now, let me just back this up and kind of wrap this up and frame it right. Star Trek The Next Generation was another television series. It was the second one to come out. You had the original series, and then in 1987, they did a daring thing, and they tried to make another Star Trek, right, with the Enterprise and everything, but a whole new cast of characters. And it worked. It was effective, you know. It took a little bit to catch people, but it was done pretty good. They were flying around in the Enterprise 1701-D throughout the duration of that television series, which ran, 7-8 seasons, 1987-1994, right? Star Trek Generations, which I mentioned, came out in 1994. So it was right at the end of the production, but it was at the beginning of the Next Generation story, which worked backwards as a bridge back to Captain Kirk and the previous original Star Trek crew. During Star Trek The Next Generation, in 1990, there was a single episode that went back in time and revealed to us, showed to us, the Enterprise 1701-C, right? So there was a dash C after the movie of the Star Trek Generations, right, which had the 1701-B, there was a 1701-C, and then when Star Trek The Next Generation actually started and took, Picard was on 1701-D, right? So now you've got 1701, 1701-A, B, C, and D, plus the NXL one that predates all of them, right? That was the VW bug version. And then NCC-1701-E is the movies that were related to Star Trek The Next Generation. There was a sequence of movies. I think there was three of them, maybe four. Well, the three of them that came out, I think there was four altogether, but the three of them that came out between 96 and 2002 were taking place on a new Starship Enterprise, which was the 1701E. Worth mentioning about this, though, DE, from D forward, possibly from C forward, but definitely from D forward. When you were watching Star Trek The Next Generation, their Enterprise actually could decouple and split into two. So you could take all the family of the administrative people and all the office workers and shit like that. And you can like dump them somewhere out in space and then go fight a battle with the rest of the ship and then come back and recouple. You know, so I thought that was really cool innovation in a story, which made a lot of sense. Because he's, you know, when I talk about a spaceship here, a starship here, the original series, I think they had like a crew of like 400 and something, and it just got bigger and bigger through time, right? More and more people, maybe into the thousands. I don't really remember in The Next Generation how many people were aboard that, but I think it was a lot. You know, it was huge. These starships, they were in excess of 300 meters in length. That's three football fields for one vehicle. They're fucking big, right? It's not some little fucking TIE fighter from Star Wars or something like that. So anyway, moving on. So, yeah, you had E in these Next Generation movies between 96 and 2002. And now, and it hasn't been revealed yet, there hasn't been shown in video, hasn't been presented in any way to anybody, Star Trek Picard, right? There's a new series that started in 2021. It's two seasons are out. They're going to release a third season this year. And in this third season, they're going to have the NCC-1701-F, right? Star Trek Picard. I started watching that. It's a little slow. I didn't find it captivating. There's two seasons of it out there. I probably watched like four or five episodes. I'll come back to it. Especially now, knowing that there's going to be an Enterprise involved, which means they're going to get out into space and do shit again. That's kind of the aspect of it that I like. And I think I'll get into that in a little while. And just, so that doesn't exist yet, but it will. I mean, the story's made, the production has happened. It's just going to be released sometime later this year, 2023. And there's another one. There's another one out there that I somehow missed because I did not see Star Trek Enterprise from 2004. I did not go through that entire series yet. I only watched like one season of it. There's a couple more out there that I haven't seen. So in one of the episodes, they go into an alternate timeline where obviously they go way out into the future and there's an iteration of the Enterprise that's called the NCC-1701-J, right? So we go from E to G, F to J. There's no G, H, or I. So do the math. There's probably plans somewhere in the Star Trek production universe for filling up those gaps, right? So now I mentioned about non-Enterprise Star Trek spinoffs. That's what I refer to them as. To me, these are not the real deal. There's Star Trek, and Star Trek has to have the Enterprise, right? You ain't got the Enterprise, it just ain't fully and completely Star Trek as far as I'm concerned, because you have a direct line, just a linear movement through time with iterations of the Enterprise. And then as you go through that, alongside of what's going on, you'll have these other versions of Star Trek. They're like wannabe Star Treks, almost Star Treks, pseudo Star Treks, you know? Like Star Trek, but not quite Star Trek. And like during the time of Star Trek The Next Generation, right, about halfway through their production, they came up with this spinoff called Deep Space Nine. Deep Space Nine is a space station, right? So it's just this static, hovering entity out in space, a station where vehicles come in and park and people get out and they go to the bar and they rent rooms and hotels and all this stuff, right? And it just, to me, it ain't the same. To me, it's the element of the exploration and adventure. It's that going out, you know, finding, discovering, breaking barriers, you know, just having that element in the story as like a continually flowing current, right? You know, an actual reality in a story that's always an ongoing thing. They're always moving through time. They're always looking for shit. They're always engaging with things that are unknown. To me, that's a very masculine quality. Whereas a space station just hovering, it's very domestic. It's very homey. And it's very matronly. It's very feminine. You know, at some deeper level of my psyche, it just does not appeal to me with all the same energy that the Enterprise out there discovering would have. Now, it's not to say that every single quote-unquote non-Enterprise Star Trek spinoff is going to be based on a space station like that. You know, the other spin-offs that are non-Enterprise will be on starships, but different starships. There's a Discovery, which is actually modern. I think it's in its third season, too, or maybe long. What was it, 2017 or 2018 it came out. So it's kind of pretty far along. It's like four or five seasons into it. I watched a few episodes, and then let's just say I lost interest. Right? I lost interest and moved on from that. It's just, it ain't the Enterprise. It ain't the same. I think what happens with a lot of these spinoff shows, I think what happens is that the production team, the writers, they try to do things that are culturally daring, but off on these little side jags. You know, you've got your continuity along the Enterprise, but when you want to try some shit, you do it on these spinoffs and see how it flies, right? I think that's what's going on with it. That seems to be the case, and without getting into any detail about it, right? So look at what I'm talking about. We're following this one spaceship through its iterations through time, you know, through our culture from the 60s to now. We're talking 56 years. It's made an impact, right? It's made an impact. That's a vehicle that carries crew. And the crew experiences things throughout the universe. And in these experiences, stories are made. And in these stories, there are lessons learned, you know? And it's just a great thing. It's a great thing, you know? Very culturally relevant through time on all kinds of levels, you know? And the ultimate impact is that, like, people really love the show. Like, I like it. I don't like everything, but I like a lot of it, and most of it is worth my passive attention, right? Leisurely activity. It's pre-sleep, before I'm ready to fall asleep, I can watch something like this that, while it can stir your mind and cause you to think, at the same time, it's a mindless activity. All, you know, audience activity is leisurely. You're not working at anything. You're just kind of laying there, right? Or sitting there, whatever the case may be. So, But people have, like they tend to do, have become very fanatical about it to some crazy extremes. It's caused some problems with some people somewhere along the way. You know, the iconic character, Captain Kirk, originally portrayed by an actor named William Shatner, had issues in the 80s with what's called Trekkies, right? Trekkies, or the big fanatics of Star Trek, right? And he had some descriptions, you know, adjectives that describe these people, and it's described cynically in a very negative light. And, you know, I wish I had it in front of me to read. I read about it. It's kind of funny, but, you know, if you're from my generation, Generation X, and you lived through those times, and you've seen the evolution of Trekkies through time, you know that back in the 70s and 80s, it was a negative connotation to be regarded as a Trekkie. These were some really fucking weird weirdos, right? And there's a lot of fans of Star Trek, conversely, that don't want to be associated with that. You know, it's like, I can appreciate the show. I could spend time watching it. It's kind of fun to talk about with other people who are familiar, you know, with the stories. Potentially, I really haven't engaged much in those conversations. I've seen other people do it. I think I can have a good time about that. But, you know, that kind of person, me, you know, I'm not a Trekkie. So they came up with another word for somebody who's less fanatical. It's Trekker. So there's like this whole Trekker, Trekkie thing going on. And, you know, the weirdness of the Trekkies, you know, can be observed. And I may want to do this someday. I may want to go ramble at a, if something just kind of falls in my lap, it'll probably never happen. You know, I'm not really that enthusiastic about it. But they have conventions, right? They do Star Trek conventions. And these fanatical people will show up over there. And, you know, it's just a convention like any other convention. And then it's all based on Star Trek stuff. So you get all kinds of Star Trek, you know, bling and memorabilia, posters and books and ashtrays and coffee mugs, and you know, and you spend time with other like-minded people, and these people like go to the extreme of like dressing up in Star Trek wardrobe, you know, design clothing, you know, emulating other characters, playing out scenes and shit like that, and it gets a little bit weird, you know. It gets a little bit weird for some. For others, it's just, you know, thing to do. But at the heart of it all is like the opportunity to meet some of the actors that portrayed the characters in all these different versions and varieties of productions in the Star Trek universe, right? So they have these conventions, and they have like, you know, there's actual official ones. Like the next official one is supposed to, well, was supposed to be in May of this year, 2023, in Seattle, Washington, right? It's the Star Trek Mission Seattle. And for whatever reason, they canceled it. And there's no telling what the reason may be. I can't find the reason for it. But, you know, in a very weird time, in a very strange world, Seattle's one of the weirdest of the weird places in this country. And there's just no telling what's gone on over there to make that fall apart. But it fell apart. So there won't be no Mission Seattle in 2023. Unofficially, however, there's other types of conventions. And there's one from a group called Creation Entertainment that's been doing it for some amount of years. In fact, they've done it in Dallas at least once before, from what I could tell. Again, I don't know about this shit. I just found out what I need to find out to express it here for you. Creation Entertainment's unofficial convention this year is going to be in Vegas in August, right? So August 23, Las Vegas, there's a Star Trek convention there. So if you're interested in this sort of thing, that's where you could look into it deeper. Do some cultural studies and get on the overnightscape.com and report it to the rest of us, because I'm not going to be there. So that's it. Enterprise from an amusement ride in New Jersey to a Trekkie convention in Las Vegas and to all points in the entire universe between there and here. Signing off now. Adios.
Thank you for tuning into Post Alan Monologics. Please understand that this project is meant to be part of a long-term archive as a series of snapshots reflecting a distant past. We are not seeking advertisers, but may at times accept private anonymous donations to help mitigate production costs. Further information involving this project and archived releases of Post-Arlen Monologics can be accessed over the World Wide Web at postarlen.com and at onsert.com. Comments, critiques, and inquiries may be submitted to Maverick through email at maverick88@postarlen.com.